Welcome to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a weekly roundtable discussion of events and issues facing the church and culture today. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Diocese of Colorado Springs and the Catholic Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Welcome, everyone. This is Bishop Michael Sheridan, and on today's program, I'll be visiting with Dale Ahlquist. Dale is the founder and president of the American Chesterton Society and co-founder of the Chesterton Academy, but I think is most familiar to any of you familiar with EWTN. He is the host, the star, shall we say, of the Apostle of Common Sense, in which he gives us insights into G.K. Chesterton, Gilbert Keith Chesterton. And Dale is a great expert on Chesterton, and we're going to find out a lot about Chesterton because Dale is here. Thank you, Dale, for being with us.
Your Excellency, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
And we were talking before we began today that Dale's been here in Colorado for a week, right?
Yes.
What are some of the appearances you've had here in Colorado?
A week ago, I started right here in Colorado Springs at St. Joseph's Church, gave a talk on Chesterton's very prophetic insights into journalism and mass communication, and went up to Fort Collins to the St. Joseph's Church there and gave a talk. A couple of nights in Denver, the big highlight of the trip has been a dedication of the G.K. Chesterton Reading Room at the St. John Vianney Seminary, and Bishop Conley was there to dedicate that, and we're going to get some serious Chesterton into the hands of those seminarians there.
Very good. Well, I hope your stay here in Colorado has been a happy one and a fruitful one. Good number of people turned out to hear you.
Very fruitful, and I never get tired of looking at mountains, so I'm always happy to visit Colorado.
There you are. Well, it's good to have you here with us today. I had mentioned at the beginning, you've been on EWTN for quite a while now, right?
Yes, I think I've lost track of how long I've been on there, but we've done six seasons of the Chesterton series, The Apostle of Common Sense, but they are spread out over more than 1 year, so we've probably been on for about 9 years.
Yeah, but now for those who might not be familiar with that program, you don't just talk about Chesterton, you portray Chesterton.
Yes, I actually don't portray him. That's another act. That's one of the great myths of our show, is that I'm the one who portrays Chesterton. I have the privilege of sitting in a wingback chair talking about Chesterton on a wonderful set that EWTN created that looks better than Masterpiece Theater. And then while I'm talking, every once in a while it'll cut to Chesterton himself sitting on a park bench in London circa 1930, and you hear Chesterton's own words by the man himself. However, it's an actor, and his name is John Chalberg, or Chuck Chalberg, and he's a history professor back in Minnesota, where I'm from, and we have been doing this tandem for quite a while.
Well, I guess that shows you that I'm not as familiar as I should be with your program, but I tell you, I don't see television of any kind much at all. Well, I wish I had more time to do it.
I don't watch the show either, Your Excellency.
But no, I have seen it, and I guess I was confused. I thought that's not you all made up there.
No, that's not. That's him all made up there, and he does have to wear quite a bit of makeup and padding because he's actually not as heavy as the great GK, so he has to wear a fat suit and everything.
Oh, well, yeah. From the photographs I've seen, he was a good size.
Yes.
He was a good sized man. We're going to have you talk about Chesterton in a while, Dale, but and of course, he was a convert from Anglicanism,
yes,
to Catholicism, and you also are a convert to Catholicism, correct?
Yes, G.K. Chesterton himself, a convert, has been a maker of converts, not only in his own lifetime, but since he left us in 1936. People who discover Chesterton start reading him, and he really does appeal to a lot of evangelicals, which is what I was. He has a way of, without you even knowing it, drawing you to the Catholic faith. And I think another notable convert here in Colorado who can attribute part of his road to Rome on reading G.K. Chesterton is Bishop Conley up in Denver.
Bishop James Conley, who's, yes, the auxiliary of Denver, who has his own fascinating conversion story. Yeah. How did you come to the Catholic? Obviously, Chesterton was instrumental. But
as a big C.S. Lewis fan, as an evangelical, I was reading a Mere Christianity one day when I was in college, And someone saw me reading the book, said, "You like C.S. Lewis?" I said, "Well, I love C.S. Lewis. Have you ever read G.K. Chesterton?" And I said, "I've never heard of G.K. Chesterton." And he said, "Well, if you love C.S. Lewis, you're going to love Chesterton. In fact, if you read Chesterton, you don't even need to read C.S. Lewis, because all of C.S. Lewis is in Chesterton." And I considered this a blasphemous remark, but that was when the seed was planted. I didn't do anything about it. I didn't act on it at that point. But then I kept running across these references to Chesterton, not only in C.S. Lewis's writings, but in elsewhere as well. I said, I've got to start reading Chesterton at some point. And I knew that the book that influenced C.S. Lewis so much, really the book that brought him to Christianity from a position of atheism, was Chesterton's book, The Everlasting Man.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so I decided that's the book I'm going to start with. And I started reading it, like anybody else, on my honeymoon.
Well, I'm sure your wife was pleased.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was a great honeymoon. I was Baptist, and like any good Baptist, we honeymooned in Rome. So we were in Rome, May of 1981. We were there the day the Pope was shot.
Were you really?
Yes.
Were you in the piazza there?
No, I wasn't, because we were, tourists on our honeymoon. We didn't follow things like that.
So you weren't there for things papal particularly.
We were there for art.
Right.
And what was so funny is that our hotel was literally two blocks from St. Peter's Square. If we had known he was going to make an appearance, we would have definitely have gone, because that certainly was something worth seeing. But we didn't know that, so we were on a tour of a different St. Peter's, the St. Peter's in chains.
Oh, yeah.
So we were looking at Michelangelo's statue of the Moses when we get the word that the Pope has been shot. And just the chaos that followed was really quite astounding. But that was my introduction to Chesterton, Your Excellency.
So you started with C.S. Lewis, moved to... this program is supposed to be about Chesterton, I know, but you talked about your familiarity with Lewis. Now, Lewis never did convert to Catholicism, but... I don't know that I've ever read anyone as Catholic who wasn't actually a Catholic than C.S. Lewis. I don't.
It's really interesting.
How do you understand his not making the jump?
Well, I think it's clearly a case of him simply not living long enough. He was on his way there. He was by the end of his life had really accepted the in principle all seven sacraments, and. He's truly one of the great ecumenical writers of the 20th century who appeals to both Catholics and Protestants alike. But what's interesting is the other great ecumenical writer of the 20th century is G.K. Chesterton. And G.K. Chesterton, did make the journey all the way to Rome. But he continues to appeal to the non-Catholics because, for a great part of his writing, he wasn't Catholic.
That's right.
Even
yeah.
though he was defending the Catholic Church before his Catholicism.
Why don't we begin to talk? Just present the man for our listeners, because I think although his name is well known and his works, I think maybe out of publication for a while, or certainly all back in publication and can be gotten easily. But let's introduce our listeners to the man, G.K. Chesterton.
Well, it's only proper to begin by describing him as a giant. And in every sense of the word, because he certainly was the physical giant with his great height, great size, very imposing. People were always impressed when he walked into the room. But his literary accomplishment is really incomprehensible. He was really one of the most prolific writers who ever lived. He wrote 100 books. He wrote thousands and thousands of literary essays for journals and newspapers, publications on both sides of the Atlantic. And his books really only represent less than a third of what he wrote. And then in addition to that, there are hundreds of poems, there are his novels, there are his detective stories, which he was really most famous for, the Father Brown
stories. Father
Brown,
yeah.
And during his lifetime, truly one of the giant men of letters in the world, recognizable everywhere, famous household word. Chesterton would have been required reading in virtually every English-speaking school in the world during his lifetime. So he was tremendously popular, tremendously influential in his lifetime. He died in 1936. World War II comes along. Things start changing in the academic institutions. they stop teaching Chesterton. The people who are still reading him are starting to only read him on their own because he's not being taught. So two generations were just simply cheated out of finding out who he was. And remember, he wrote about everything, and that's the biggest difficulty, Your Excellency, in dealing with Chesterton is categorizing him.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. How would you characterize his writings?
Because he does write on theology, but he's certainly not a theologian. He writes on philosophy, but you can't really call him a philosopher. He writes on social criticism and economics, literary criticism, art. His wide reach goes really across the political spectrum, so that he appeals to people on both ends of it, because he seems to be taking in everything. And all those things are present in each one of his works. So I've even heard said that, you know, bookstore owners don't put him in a particular place. They just have a Chesterton section.
Right.
That's the easiest way to deal with Chesterton, because he is his own weather that he creates.
He wrote about, I guess, the culture, I guess, by that. That's in all the elements of culture.
And he is the complete thinker and someone who really completely embraces the faith and understands the connection between faith and reason. Well, they can write about everything. They really can.
I think you've probably already answered this, but, you know, for someone who died, what, over 70 years ago now, in our age might be considered, well, someone of the past, a relic. We don't need to go back that far. But he's very much a writer, a man, a thinker for today.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Your Excellency, because the more that I read him, and I've been reading him for 30 years now, I feel like he's even more applicable, more pertinent, more for our time than for his own time. And because he saw what was coming. He had a prophetic insight, because he could see what was happening in society. He could see how all the institutions were starting to fail. And he could see that there was really only one constant thread of hope through it all, and that was the Catholic Church.
Mm. Dale, you know, I'd like to go back just for a moment. You were talking about your own journey to the Catholic Church. You talked about going to Rome for your honeymoon and being there when Pope John Paul II was shot. Your familiarity with Lewis and then with Chesterton, but What are some of those elements that actually moved you into the church? I always think that's so very interesting, certainly for me, and I think for our listeners too. What was it, if anything, other than Chesterton, or what more specifically in Chesterton did that?
You know, Chesterton actually has a book on conversion. It's called The Catholic Church in Conversion. And in there he describes the three stages of conversion. I can tell you that I went through these three stages exactly. He says the first stage is you decide you're going to be fair to the Catholic Church.
Well, there's something. there is something that would be nice.
But you see, that's what's so interesting. He says you can't be fair to the Catholic Church. As soon as you stop being against it, you suddenly feel like you're being drawn towards it. You can't be neutral about the Catholic Church. So it is simply a line of division right there. You cannot be fair to the Catholic Church.
And so that's what you can't be lukewarm, or as you said, neutral about it.
Right.
You're kind of one way or the other.
And so growing up Baptist evangelical, it was my anti-Catholicism was both subtle and overt. You know, I had things that I was considered myself absolutely repelled by. Evangelicals, we had no understanding or appreciation of the role of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So I couldn't appreciate or understand any of those things. But I said, okay, I'm going to try to figure out what they are. Oh, and then, you know, that's your, I'm going to be fair.
You're
going to
be fair. You're not going to be against the church.
Exactly. I'm not going to be against them.
So kind of an open mindedness.
We're going to let them make their case now.
All right.
And
well, that's the first stage.
Yeah, that's the first.
Dale, let's pick up on these other two stages after we just take this very small break. So we'll be right back.
Very good.
Hi, this is Patrick Madrid, host of the Thursday edition of EWTN's Open Line program, and I'd like you to join me on May 7th at the World Arena in Colorado Springs for the 2011 Rocky Mountain Catholic Men's Conference. To sign up, please go to www.rmcmc.org. That's rmcmc.org. aspire to be a man of God, and join me on May the 7th.
We're back now with Dale Ahlquist. Dale is the host of EWTN's The Apostle of Common Sense, in which he brings to life, literally, Gilbert Keith Chesterton, the great, shall we say, commentator on culture, 20th century culture, and very much the modern man also, although he went to God in 1936. And just before the break, Dale, I had asked Dale how he said that Chesterton was very instrumental in his coming to the Catholic faith from his evangelical background, and said he was following Chesterton's three stages of conversion, the first one being be fair to the Catholic Church, and that might have been difficult for you as an evangelical. There were some biases there.
Absolutely. Chesterton says it's not that you're going to necessarily believe everything the Catholic Church is saying at that point, but you're going to stop necessarily believing all the things said against it. And so that's that first fatal step when you decide you're going to be fair to the Catholic Church.
Now, what took place during that phase? What specific things did you do or read that helped you to become more acquainted with the Church?
In addition to reading Chesterton, of course, I was starting to discover the Church Fathers at this point, finding out that they were Catholic, which was a real shock. And of course, as an evangelical, I had a great love of Scripture, and to find and read their commentaries on Scripture, it just opened up the Bible in a new way for me, because they had an insight into Scripture that was so much more profound than any of the modern Bible commentaries that I was reading at the time. So that was a big thing. And then I was starting to encounter a few conversion stories at this point too. So I was reading some of the other conversion stories. I would have probably stumbled upon a Scott Hahn book or something like that.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. So I was starting to see how other people had gone through it as well.
All right. Now, how long did this first stage last?
For me, it was probably about 4 or 5 years.
Oh,
yes.
So this did not go quickly.
Yes, but that leads right into that second stage, which is really what takes the longest, and that's the discovering the Catholic Church. That's stage two. You're learning all these things that you didn't know before. And Chesterton compares it to being into discovering a foreign country where there's all these exotic birds and flowers that you didn't know existed, and you're taking it all in, and it's really a fun part of the conversion because there's no commitment. You can turn around and leave anytime you want. And that really is the most enjoyable part of the conversion right there. That's when you find yourself defending the Catholic faith not only to non-Catholics but defending it to Catholics as well.
Oh.
Because you've learned so much about
sure.
the faith. You've learned all these things that a lot of people haven't discovered. But then comes the third stage. Running away from the Catholic Church. Because the first two stages basically take care of the intellectual objections, and they clear the ground intellectually, but then it becomes a matter of the will. And your head has been convinced, but your heart is telling you, don't do this. You're going to change your whole life, and then you can't go back. And so you're trying to find a way not to become Catholic. And for a lot of evangelicals, one of the ways they do it is they start looking into the Eastern Church. And a lot of them start flirting with Eastern Orthodoxy because they know, well, we get the ancient church that way, but we don't have to have the Pope.
That's right.
Like that. And so it's just purely a stepping around Rome. And Chesterton says at the end, and this is exactly what happened to me, the convert enters the church with his head bowed because it's an act of humility. And the outsiders think that he's entering a prison. But only when the convert steps inside does he discover that the church is larger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Well, that's wonderful. That's great. I was sort of a little bit distracted as you were talking. I taught in a seminary for a number of years, and even though it's not quite conversion, I could see some of those stages at work even in the seminarians as they came to know more about God. To kind of believe in their head that this is what they were called to be, priests. But they were also sometimes running away from it because they knew finally what that step, that commitment meant that there was no turning back and that their life was going to be different forever. That's
Oh, I absolutely agree, Your Excellency. In fact, when I've talked with other priests, I think that the experience of conversion is much like the experience of discerning the vocation.
Right.
Very
marriage,
similar.
Marriage also, sure. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you. That was very helpful. So from the time that you were in Rome till the time you became a Catholic was how long?
16 years.
16 years.
16 years.
All right.
So a great and a very ironic because my journey to Rome begins in Rome. but just like there's a character in one of Chesterton's novels, the novel's called Man Alive, where this character has to he walks out the back door of his house because he wants to go see the front door of his house, but he walks all the way around the world in order to see the front of his house. And that's what I had to do. In order to get to Rome, I had to start in Rome and then go all the way around the world to get there.
Okay. Well, welcome. It's great. great to have you, Dale. Great to have you. Now, let's get back to thank you for that story about your conversion and your journey. We'll get back to Chesterton. I'm guessing maybe that even by now some of our listeners might be thinking I'd like to get into this guy. It can be daunting, you know. We think of this British intellectuals could be off-putting. You know, will I understand Chesterton? Is he going to be over my head? How would you begin to encourage perhaps someone who doesn't have any familiarity with Chesterton to get moving in that direction?
Well, that is part of the main work that I do with the American Chesterton Society. We're trying to introduce the world or reintroduce the world to Chesterton. So we have many different techniques we use. Obviously, our webpage, chesterton.org, is itself an introduction to Chesterton. There's lots of great material on there. The EWTN series, which in Colorado plays on Sunday nights about 7 p.m. was when it would come on. That is a very, very easy and delightful way to discover Chesterton. And then I've written two books, which are both introductory books to Chesterton. One's called The Apostle of Common Sense, like the television series, and the other one is Common Sense 101, Lessons from G.K. Chesterton. And the first book gives you an overview of Chesterton's writing. The second one is Chesterton by theme, taking him a theme at a time. And both have been very well received. Other people who've read them say this is a great way to start Chesterton. But for those who think that they're ready to just dive in and start chewing on him, you have to be prepared to let him lead you. You have to throw yourself at his mercy as a writer because he doesn't write like anyone else. And he will take you on the scenic route to every one of his points. But I would say start with a book of essays like Tremendous Trifles is a good way to start. The Father Brown Stories is a good way to start. His book What's Wrong with the World is a good way to start. But I wouldn't start the way I did it. Don't start with The Everlasting Man.
Yeah, okay.
Work your way up to that. And his other really foundational book is Orthodoxy.
That's right.
And Orthodoxy is really the trunk of the tree, you know, that all the branches of Chesterton come from that book. But I also don't recommend that as the first book unless if you read that as your first Chesterton book, you have to also read it as your second and your third Chesterton book, because that book doesn't really bear fruit till the third reading.
Okay. what would be some of the the lessons, the great messages, if you will, that Chesterton would have for people in our society, in our world today?
Well, I would say his fundamental lesson is this sense of gratitude and wonder at the world. He is one who just appreciates everything and makes us look at life in a new way. He tries to get us to see the same things that we've always been looking at, but to see them for the first time. And that has to do with absolutely everything. But he's a defender of the family. He makes us realize that the family is what really... the family doesn't prepare us for the world. The family is the world. That's what our lives are being prepared to live in, a family. And the world has that backwards. They think that the home is just this dropping off point for everything else. No, it's the outside the world that's narrow, and it's inside the home that is really the important place where life is lived. And so everything is comes back to the family. He also shows us how every truth is connected to every other truth. So he again, we talked before how he can't be categorized. The danger in the modern world is that we specialize too quickly, and people become very fragmented thinkers. Chesterton puts it all together, and so he teaches you how to be a complete thinker. And so a sense of wonder and gratitude, complete thinking, and then that last concept that is so fundamental to Chesterton is paradox, that the truth is the opposite of what you expect. And there seems to be a contradictory element to truth, but the cross has a contradiction at its center too. So it all comes back to that.
It's probably an understatement to say that he could turn a phrase. A lot of what I see are just the one-liners from Chesterton. He and many of those are of that paradoxical form. He had a great wit about him.
Yes. In fact, if people just read the one-liners, that would be good enough too. We have a whole page of Chesterton quotations on our webpage, but yeah, we should probably lay out a few of those. I mean, one of his famous lines is, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried." And the Bible tells us to love our neighbors and to love our enemies, generally because they're the same person. You know, and angels fly because they take themselves lightly. You know, it just shows his marvelous wordplay. And the way he could turn the phrase, as you say, take away the supernatural, and what remains is the unnatural. Just let that one hang in the air for a minute, you know. And that's the way they all are. They make you think, whoa, that's really good. And, he says, men do not dispute again about what is evil. They only dispute about which evils are acceptable.
I think I've heard that one.
So there's just one right after the other, and he's been called the Shakespeare of the aphorism. He truly is one of the most quotable writers in the English language, so there is such a delight in that. And that's, you know, one of the problems in reading Chesterton is those great quotations will jump off the page at you. You're going to be compelled to underline it, and then you lose track of the argument that he's making because he's just laid you flat with a really good quotation.
That's right. You know, you told your story of coming to the Catholic Church. Chesterton came to the Catholic Church from Anglicanism. Maybe his journey wasn't quite as far as yours. Did Chesterton in any way say come out of Newman's Oxford movement kind of thinking? Was he already very close to Catholicism, or would you say he was more Protestant?
Well, what's interesting there is he actually had to come a lot farther than I came, because I was raised in a Christian home. Chesterton was not. He was raised in a very non-creedal home. He had a very loving middle-class family, but they exposed him to everything, and they did not really teach him any faith. And so he had to first discover Christianity before discovering,
so he was not raised really as a Christian.
No, and not raised as an Anglican either.
Oh, so when did he come to Anglicanism?
He came to Anglicanism right at the turn of the century, and that's really when he became a Christian. And his book Orthodoxy sort of describes his journey towards Christianity. But the reason he entered the Anglican Church is that's his fiancée was a very devout Anglican, Francis, and he describes her as the first Christian he'd ever met who was happy.
Really?
Yeah, so she played this really huge role in his becoming a Christian. In fact, he dedicates his magnificent epic poem, The Ballad of the White Horse, is dedicated to his wife, who he says, who brought the cross to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm anxious to pick up on this story. We have to take another break, so hold that thought.
Okay.
This is Father Larry Richards, author of Be a Man, and I want you to join me on May 7th at World Arena in Colorado Springs for the 2011 Rocky Mountain Catholic Men's Conference. To sign up, go to www.rmcmc.org. Aspire to be a man of God and join me on May 7th.
Welcome back. We are here today with Dale Ahlquist, Chesterton scholar, and if you've been with us for the for the first part of our program, someone who can communicate very well the essence of the great G.K. Chesterton. And before our last break, we were beginning to talk about Chesterton's own conversion to Catholicism. Dale reminded me of something that I had forgotten, and that is that Chesterton was not really even raised as a Christian. He came to Christianity in its Anglican form a little later in his own life.
Yes, and that journey towards Christianity was quite a speckled route, because even though he had a great mind and truly a sense of innocence about him always, he was dabbling in some strange things, because he was looking into spiritualism for a while.
He was in the occult.
Yeah, actually messing with the occult for a while, and he said he actually believed in the devil before he believed in God. And so that was a very dark period that actually kind of led him to the edge of the abyss. At one point, I think he contemplated even ending his own life, because it was such a dark, dark experience he was having. And he said the thing that saved him was simply grasping one axiomatic truth, which was existence is better than non-existence.
He wasn't an atheist, was he?
Well, he considered himself an atheist when he was a late adolescent of 16 or 17. Okay. He'd really lost his faith in anything at that point.
That's kind of a phase.
It was a phase he was going through. But it was shortly after that where he was very rudderless and experimenting with different things and exposing himself to all kinds of different thinking and different philosophies. And as he explains in Orthodoxy, it wasn't reading any classic defenses of the Christian faith that led him to the church. It was actually reading the enemies of the church. He was reading all these strange modern philosophies, and he realized one of the things that they all had in common was, first of all, if you took any of them to their logical conclusion, it would end in madness. Not only madness, but suicidal madness. They were all self-destructive philosophies. But the other thing they all had in common is that they all attacked Christianity. They all attacked the church. And they all attacked from different angles. And that's what led him to think that, well, maybe the church is the thing in the center. And maybe all these other things are the wrong things.
The church sort of became the alternative, I guess. Or
well, not so much the alternative as the only thing that made any sense.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And truly answered it answered everything. It was the only thing that had an answer at every angle, at every perspective, no matter what the enemy or what the opposition was doing. And they would attack the church for opposite reasons. You know, some would say, well, the church is too ascetic and too plain and too colorless. And then other people would say, the church is too overdone and too colorful and too flamboyant. And you know, the church emphasizes celibacy, so they have the wrong view of sex. And then the church emphasizes having children, so they have the wrong view of sex. And so he said, well, if something is described as too tall and too short and too red and too green and too black and too white, maybe it's exactly right.
Yeah. That's what, you know, you in your travels, you've spoken to so many people, and I suspect in the context of your talks, you've had the opportunity even to meet people individually. Has that been an experience that other people, as far as you know, have also had, that they've come to the church because everything else was a dead end?
I have really had the great privilege of speaking all over the country on Chesterton, and of course the television show gets great exposure too. So not only in the people I meet, but in the emails I receive, I have the great privilege of helping escort people into the Catholic Church, because they have Chesterton is they find Chesterton and they see, oh, the Catholic Church makes sense in a way that I've never realized before. But it was because they read Chesterton, because they encountered Chesterton, they started thinking about the Catholic Church. And so he really does have a way of opening up thinking that the modern world doesn't let us think that way. And Chesterton really completely goes against that kind of thinking. It's so refreshing when they discover that.
So this brought him to Anglicanism, which of course was the, I guess, the religion, the church of his homeland. How long did he, was he an ardent Anglican, a real practicing Anglican, or?
Well, the great story is it was to answer your question, Your Excellency, it was about a 21-year journey to the Catholic Church after he was received into the Anglican Church. And I think one of the main things that kept it such a slow journey was the fact that his wife really showed no inclination to ever become Catholic. She was a very devout Anglican, and yet she could see that he was moving towards Rome the whole time. And part of it had to do with his growing friendship with Father John O'Connor, a priest who became really the inspiration for the Father Brown character. And Frances, his wife, was actually as dependent and as good a friend with Father O'Connor as was Gilbert Keith Chesterton. But when he finally made the move and made the decision to become Catholic, it was bittersweet for both his wife and him, because she knew that's what he wanted, and he knew that's what he wanted, but they all of a sudden didn't share something in their life, and they didn't share the most fundamental thing in their life, their faith. And so the day he was received, it was really both tearful and joyful for both of them. The story ends happily that she was received 4 years later. But what was great is that the Anglican vicar of Beaconsfield, the town where he lived, said, "Well, I'm glad that Chesterton is becoming Catholic. He was never a very good Anglican." The fact is, he never did go to church as an Anglican. He was a Christian completely in principle and in his theology, but not a practicing Anglican. Whereas when he became Catholic, he never missed a day of obligation. All of a sudden, the real presence became real. And he said, "Only a religion that is true could get me out of bed this early in the morning."
That makes sense. That makes sense. That's right. So he was a Catholic for how long before he died?
So 1922 is when he was received into the church. He died in 1936.
So last 14.
And during that time, he visited Rome, had an audience with Pope Pius XI, was made a knight of the Order of St. Gregory. And upon his death, Cardinal Pacelli, the future Pius XII, sent a telegram on behalf of the Holy Father saying, to Francis and to the Catholic Church in England, the Holy Father deeply mourns the loss of Gilbert Keith Chesterton, a gifted defender of the Catholic faith. Gifted defender of the faith. That phrase could not be printed in the British newspapers because only the King of England is the defender of the faith.
Oh, that's right. So even to say defender of the Catholic faith, they couldn't.
Yeah. He said defender of the faith.
Oh, just defender of the faith.
That's what he said in the telegram, yeah. A gifted defender of the faith. They couldn't print that in the newspapers.
Well, you're right. His journey to Catholicism was a little longer and more difficult than yours.
And yet, he's defending the Catholic faith long before his conversion. In fact, he even said at one point, he was standing at the door of the church ushering others in without having entered himself.
Oh, that's great. Repeat for us. It's good to do this more than once. Repeat for us, for our listeners, I should say, some of the works that you mentioned before that would be good introductions if they want to get into Chesterton.
Sure. Well, my two books are The Apostle of Common Sense and Common Sense 101, Lessons from G.K. Chesterton. There's a biography by Joseph Pierce called Wisdom and Innocence, another good introduction. And the principal Chesterton works that at some point everyone should read would be Orthodoxy, The Everlasting Man, his book on St. Francis of Assisi, his book on St. Thomas Aquinas, What's Wrong with the World, and one that I recommend everyone read if they can, his book on Charles Dickens.
That's right. He wrote something on Charles Dickens. What was that all about?
Well, he was a big fan of Dickens, and Dickens was actually fading from the public memory when in Chesterton's early career, and the book that he wrote on Dickens actually created a revival of Dickens in England, and he really helped bring Dickens back to popularity. But what he's found in Dickens was this appreciation of the human character. And all those wonderful, colorful Dickens characters just leap to life off the pages. But they represent God's goodness and variety and a very positive, hopeful outlook towards life itself. And in the introduction to that book, Chesterton, twisting Dante, says, "Abandon all hopelessness, you who enter here," when you enter into the world of Dickens. And the great line, Chesterton says that, you know, when you read a book that you really are enjoying, you don't want it to end. You know, most books you read, you want to get to the end and get to the conclusion and put the book away. But a really good book that's really doing it for you, you want it to go on forever. And Chesterton says the Dickens books have a way of once you're inside them, you're on this really wonderful journey that you don't want to end.
Did you dub Chesterton the apostle of common sense?
Yes, that was my doing, and I think that phrase really does sum him up. Because
that's fascinating to me. You associate Chesterton with common sense.
Yeah, he says what we all know to be true, but we don't even recognize that it's true until he said it. We have gotten so far from the truths that we hold in common because the modern world is so broken and we have such strange thinking. Common sense simply means that truth that we really do hold in common, even if we've forgotten that we do hold it in common.
Oh, well, that's a great name. Now I'm going to ask you a question, which I always hate being asked. So now it's my turn to do it to you. Do you have a favorite work of Chesterton?
Well, good. I will ask you the question too then, Your Excellency, since because Turnabout is fair play. So you be prepared to answer it as well. But I really do hate the question. You're right. Because, you know, one of the great answers to that question is, well, it's the book I just read, you know. His book, Orthodoxy, is really this fundamental book that you do keep returning to. But that Charles Dickens book is really that's why I mentioned it. It's so surprisingly good, and it makes you think about so many things that I never get tired of rereading that one. But as for his novels, I my favorite is Man Alive, if I can separate the three genres there, the more theological philosophical one would be Orthodoxy, the more literary criticism would be Charles Dickens, and then the novel is Man Alive.
All right. You know, and I have to confess, I should have done better preparation for this program. It's been a while. So I remember, I guess my introduction to Chesterton was as a seminarian.
Okay.
And it was Everlasting Man. I think the very first, whether that was the best way to start or not, was the very first one.
Not sure.
But being a fan of mystery novels, and I tell you, I used to love to read mystery novels. I'm lucky to get through the newspaper these days. But his Father Brown mystery, those have been made into movies, haven't they, some of them?
Well, there was a 1970s series that took about 20 or so of the...
Was that a TV series?
Yeah, the TV series.
That's what I'm thinking
British
of, maybe.
But there were two movies made, and Alec Guinness starred in one back
in the
1950s.
Right. Yeah.
But they really have never been done the way they should be.
Oh, really?
So that's hopefully going to happen in our future. We did make a film on one Father Brown story for EWTN. It's called The Honor of Israel Gao. It's very faithful to the original, and we produced it down at EWTN. It's one of the best things that EWTN has ever produced.
Has it shown a number of times?
They play it every once in a while, but you can get the DVD of it from our website.
I'm going to look into that.
I can find
another break. We'll be back.
Hi, I'm a wife and mother in the Diocese of Colorado Springs, and I want to ask all women listening to encourage your husbands to attend the 2011 Rocky Mountain Catholic Men's Conference on May 7th at World Arena. Yes, that is Mother's Day weekend, but I can't think of a better gift that my husband can give me that weekend than to go to the conference. To sign up, go to www.rmcmc.org. That's www.rmcmc.org.
Welcome back. My guest today is Dale Ahlquist, who is the founder and president of the American Chesterton Society. And Dale, earlier in the program, you said that the American Chesterton Society really exists to promote and reintroduce to today's generations the great writings of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. And you're also the co-founder of the Chesterton Academy. I want to talk about that in just a moment. But, you know, it occurs to me that for someone who wrote and spoke, who was such a public person as Chesterton, certainly there had to be some misconceptions. Did what he wrote, did what he say ever get him in trouble? Where did he have his enemies?
Well, Chesterton was certainly a controversialist, and he loved controversy. He loved to engage people in argument, and he saw the direction the modern world was going, and he was very much opposed to it. In fact, one of the great lines from Everlasting Man is the dead thing goes with the stream, only the living thing can go against it. You know, and Chesterton is clearly going against the stream of the modern world. And his book, What's Wrong with the World, he identifies four major problems that are wrong with the modern world. And this is written 100 years ago now, Your Excellency. The four things he identified were big government, big business, feminism, and public education.
Well, we could do a program on each one of those.
We certainly could.
I'm guessing that most people think feminism is a rather recent invention. What form did feminism take? Was he opposed to women voting and things like that?
Well, the ironic thing was, and this will really raise hairs, but he was opposed to women voting because he believed that families should vote as a unit, because the family is the basic unit of society, not the individual. If you start promoting individual interests, all of a sudden they all cluster into special interests. Whereas if the family votes together, then the family is the special interest that's represented by the government. And that's, the government is there to serve the family. Everyone forgets that. We're not here to serve the government. The government is there to nurture, protect, and do everything it can to keep the family the center of society. And so that was his argument against the women voting. But his other thing is, you know, he is a great defender of democracy. And most women were opposed to the vote. And so he says, if you really believe in democracy, well, let the women vote on whether they should vote, because they would, most of them at the time would vote against it. And that was the fact. It was only a minority of women who wanted the vote. People have forgotten that. But that was not the issue with feminism with him. The issue was that the role of the woman was being degraded by feminism. They forgot that the most important role of the woman is to be a mother. And feminism had told the lie that women would be more fulfilled outside of the home. But Chesterton said, no, most men aren't more fulfilled outside of the home. Very few people have that career that is fulfilling. Most people work as wage slaves and in very degrading types of work. And that goes back to this problem of big government and big business, which really degrades the individual and human dignity. And Chesterton says, you know, 10,000 women marched through the streets saying, we will not be dictated to, and then they went off and became stenographers.
there is a message for today, isn't it? I mean, that's as modern as it could be. He objected to the insistence that women are better fulfilled outside the home, better fulfilled by being something other than wives and mothers.
And the whole idea is that his economic and social ideas is that families should, to the great extent as possible, own their own means of production. They should be small businesses rather than people working as wage slaves for big corporations. So he wanted to see a stronger economy by having many small individually owned businesses that were run by families rather than the father himself going outside and working and being separated from his family. So that was the ideal that really was the medieval ideal. Uh-huh. And he was just trying to say that's going to make for a more stable society. Then you'd have less clustering in the urban areas and just a greater system of social justice. And he got these ideas from the Catholic Church.
Hmm. Are there any particular writings of his where he centers in on these kinds of
things? What's wrong with the world certainly lays out the problem, and his solution is where he talks about some practical solutions is in the book The Outline of Sanity. Yeah,
The Outline of Sanity.
And then the idea with public education, the reason he's a critic of public education is because he says the government should not control education. He says the government had less power over a man when it could send him to be burnt at the stake than it does today when it sends him to the public school. It was unprecedented in all of human history to give the government that much power to actually control what is taught to our children and to make it compulsory that they have to go to the schools that are run by the government. That was a new thing in all of history.
He was objecting to what was. I mean, many people today would object to what the government says can't be taught to our children.
But it started with the fact that they were controlling education itself, and that meant both what could be and what could not be taught. Both. Yeah. And there is a good argument that the government shouldn't teach religion to your children, because do you want the government teaching religion to your children? Probably not. They're probably not the ones to do it. But when they control the schools, they are keeping religion out of it, and education doesn't make any sense without religion in it. There's all you're getting is a bunch of fragments of knowledge that are not cohesively held together because there's no underlying philosophy holding any of it together. Which is why we started Chesterton Academy.
yeah, that's okay. Let's do that before we run out of time today. Tell us about the Chesterton Academy, which is different than the American Chesterton Society.
Right, a different entity altogether. We started this new high school in the Twin Cities, just outside of Minneapolis, 3 years ago. It's in our third year, but our basic philosophy is that it's not only public education, but also private education, which simply apes public education, just takes the wrong approach to teaching because everything is so fragmented and broken and not connected to one philosophy to hold everything together. So we have a very integrated classical curriculum. You know, we start with Latin and the classics and Homer and Plato, and they get Aristotle by their sophomore year. So laying a good foundation, but then it's connected to the Catholic faith. So it starts with daily Mass. They get the Old Testament first, then the New Testament. So these things are taught along with the ancient philosophy. So the two strains of faith and reason are always connected together. But it also affects the arts. So we teach, you know, the Word has to become flesh. So everyone learns how to draw. Everyone learns how to sing, to act, to speak. So we emphasize the arts as much as the sciences at our school.
This is college level. No,
this is a high school.
This is high school.
This is a high school, yeah.
This is high school.
Yeah. And these kids will get a better education than most people get in college.
Would this be similar to what we think of as a great books curriculum?
It's a classical curriculum, but it's not really a great books program, although we do emphasize readings of some of the classics, but it's not really the great books program. It's something distinct from it. It's a curriculum that we've created.
And you said the goal is to have a unified...
Yeah, we want to have complete thinkers. That's why Chesterton is the perfect patron for this school, because he's the model of a complete thinker. And we want to create students who come out of there who really, really do have it all together, who are complete thinkers, who are able to defend their faith coherently and articulately, but also they can see how everything fits together. We specialize way too soon on kids today, and they are made as narrow as possible as soon as possible.
And that's the truth. When I was in college, I remember we were forbidden to state a major, I think, until we were juniors. Now I think when they walk through the door, they have to tell them what the major is.
Yeah, that makes no sense. Yeah. Makes no sense.
Yeah, it cuts off a grade. When was the school established?
Just 3 years ago. We're in our third year right now. And when we started with 10 students, we had 20 the second year. We have 40 this year, so we're doubling every year. So Your Excellency, at the end of 30 years, everyone in the entire world will attend the school if we keep doubling every year.
No, what is your capacity, or what is your goal capacity?
We realize you can't be too big our plan is to segregate students by gender. So when we're big enough, we're going to be able to have separate classes with the boys and the girls. They would have drama and music together. But ideally, 20 kids in each gender in each class. So that's what gives us 40, 80, 160 would be an ideal school for what we can do.
And it's recognized as a Catholic school?
We're an independent Catholic school. We're working. We have an open relationship with the Archdiocese, but we're technically not a diocesan school, so we're independent Catholic school because we have to prove ourselves to them. We have a very good relationship with the Archdiocese of Minneapolis and St. Paul, so...
That sounds great. There are a number of, as you well know, smaller colleges that have risen up. But to hear about a high school like this is great. Well, Dale, we are quickly coming to the end of our time, and it's really been great to have you. And as I said, I learned a great deal, and I'm going to dust off my Chesterton and get back to reading some more of that. So
then I've accomplished my goal, Your Excellency.
So thank you very much for being with us, and because we have so little time, maybe we'll just pray the Hail Mary together and conclude.
Be delighted.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. And may Almighty God bless you all, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Join us each week as Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs discusses topics relevant to your life and your faith. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Catholic Radio Network and the Diocese of Colorado Springs. If there is a topic that you'd like to hear covered by Bishop Sheridan Presents, please call the Catholic Radio Network at 970-669-8000. Thanks again for listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents, brought to you by the Colorado Catholic Herald, the official newspaper of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Hi. I'm a wife and mother in the Diocese of Colorado Springs, and I want to ask all women listening to encourage your husbands to attend the 2011 Rocky Mountain Catholic Men's Conference on May 7th at World Arena. Yes, that's Mother's Day weekend, but I can't think of a better gift that my husband can give me that weekend than to go to this conference. To sign up, go to www.rmcmc.org. That's www.rmcmc.org.